Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, arts editor at the TLS. Our usual host, Thea Lenarduzzi, is away this week, so I asked our own Toby Lischtig, fiction and politics editor, to help me out. Hello, Toby, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Lucy. How are you doing?
All right, thank you. A little bit warm, not allowed to complain about it.
No, we need to revel in it. It's beautiful.
Exactly. So last week we talked about recommendations for Independent Bookshop Week, which starts, I think, this Saturday. So, Toby, have you got any? Can I put you on the spot? Have you got any favourite independent
bookshops? You can. I mean, like most other people during this pandemic, I haven't really strayed out of my postcode very much. So I'm going to stick to the N16 postcode, for that is where I live. And we've actually got at least two independent bookshops. One is the Stoke Newington Bookshop on Stoke Newington High Street, and it's fantastic, actually. It's really, really well stocked and really responsive, and the staff know a huge amount, and they will get in books for you at, you know, the ping of an email. So, I've really avoided Amazon for quite a long time now, because I'll get them in. And then there's the other sort of less fancied but equally marvellous Church Street Bookshop on Church Street, Stoke Newington Church Street, which is mostly secondhand books. It's much smaller, but it's a kind of dusty trove, the likes of which seem to be fading away in our world. But
we like a dusty trove, don't we?
We like a dusty trove, and it's managed to stay on, and it's certainly survived the pandemic. And they've both opened up again a while ago. And yeah, I heartily recommend both of them.
Well, they sound brilliant, and we have had we've been canvassing opinion externally and internally, and we've got a lot of wonderful recommendations, which I think we're going to talk about mostly next week in actual Independent Bookshop Week. But they range from, certainly throughout the whole country, and now I think about it, we've got one in Germany. So if you've got any more, if you want to share your recommendations with us, do tweet us at the TLS or send an email to letters@the-tls.co.uk, nominating your local or most cherished independent bookshop, and tell us what you think sets them apart. And don't forget to let us know if you're happy for us to name you on the show along with your offering. Coming up on this week's show, we have a look into the lost world of coal mining and British labourism, and a landmark discovery from a few hundred years ago, but still a discovery, along with how to write and decode an obituary and what the Buddha's wife might have thought about the man and his life. But first, we're going to talk about perhaps the composer that everybody knows and, more unusually, nearly everybody loves. As one of the books under review calls him, the bone-deep artist, absorbing material wherever he found it for the purpose of putting on a show. And, as our reviewer Paul Griffiths continues, so many shows he put on. Shows for two hands at a keyboard, shows to take over a church and make its ceremony into theatre, shows for a soloist finding partners and supporters within an orchestra, shows for a voice enacting sexual potency or melancholy or goodness of heart or pubertal yearning or omnivolent redemption. Beautiful shows too. So I think you might be there with me now. We are talking about Mozart. Paul Griffiths has written us a beautiful piece and is here now to talk it through with us. Paul, many thanks for joining us.
Hello, Lucy. Pleasure to be here.
So the first thing you reviewed for us, very excitingly, was a live new production at the Royal Opera House, wasn't it? What was it like, first of all, just to be there in the Opera House at a live show, and what was the production like?
Yeah, well, it was amazing to be back after 14 months of the place being dark, at least as far as large-scale opera is concerned, and everybody there. As I say in the piece, the front of house staff were welcoming you back and thanking you for coming, which doesn't normally happen at the Royal Opera House.
No, you don't. They don't usually say thank you, do they?
So they don't normally say thank you, no. But it was a spaced audience, obviously about, I would reckon, 25% of the seats were used, every other row and every other seat within those rows. So that sort of works out at 25%. But applauding as if the house was full. And being given quite a show on stage by a wonderful cast of singers.
So it was La Clemenza di Tito. What was the sort of the theory behind the production?
Well, it was updated. I mean, it was roughly modern times. And there was a kind of flicking between a classical facade, which was just largely white, took shadows very nicely. And if you turned it around, it became a kind of high school, I suppose, with Vitellia, the baddie of this opera, as a mistress, and the prime goodie, Sesto, it's normally sung by a woman these days, as a sort of football star of the soccer team. And you might have thought it was a little bit strange, but to have a young woman dressed in a football shirt and shorts, it's actually not so dissimilar from the outline of a Roman infantry uniform. So it kind of worked. And although it was updated, the plot hinges on an assault on the capital, the Roman capital, I should say, not that in Washington, D.C., but there was no attempt to point any contemporary reference, which I think was a very good idea. It worked, and it was brilliantly sung, and that's three quarters of the battle with this piece.
And you say the piece, it hinges basically around quite a short moment of grace, Servilia's aria.
Yes, and everybody in this opera is under extreme pressure, and there is this moment. It's 9/10 of the way through the opera when people have been singing out their anguish at having to do what they don't want to do. And Servilia, who is the least important of the main characters, of the singing characters, comes on and she just has this 2-minute aria, which is exquisitely beautiful. And I think Mozart designed it to sort of bring down peace on the characters, on the situation, and it certainly worked that way in this performance.
And as you say in the piece, La Clemenza di Tito, the opera itself, it has strong links to Prague, doesn't it, as Mozart himself did, and the first book you've reviewed was by Daniel E. Freeman, and that tells us about Mozart's special relationship with the city, does it?
Yes, I think one of the joys of this book is to point up how much Mozart was admired in Prague. And Daniel Freeman starts out telling us that a week after Mozart's funeral, he famously had a very simple burial in Vienna. But a week after that, there was a great memorial in Prague with 4,000 people attending a Requiem Mass in one of the big churches of the city. And I think they did so because they loved Mozart's music, and they also remembered his three recent visits, two of them to put on new operas in Prague. It's often forgotten that Don Giovanni was first performed not in Vienna, but in Prague, and then was revised by Mozart for production in Vienna. And La Clemenza di Tito was written for Prague because it was written for the coronation of the Emperor Leopold II as King of Bohemia. The Austrian emperors in those days seemed to have gone round different cities in German-speaking Europe, getting crowned as heads of different parts of the empire, King of Bohemia, King of Hungary, and all the rest of it.
And was it Prague? This is perhaps one of the sort of myths that I was going to talk about later. Was it Prague that there's the story about you couldn't go around there without someone, you couldn't walk down the street without someone whistling something from Marriage of Figaro or Don Giovanni, and people in the market and just everywhere?
Yes, and that is from one of Mozart's lovely letters, where he reports back to a friend in Vienna that he's been invited to Prague because they're nuts about the Marriage of Figaro, and everywhere he goes, somebody is playing it on a clarinet somewhere, or there's a keyboard player on the street. It was the popular music of the time, and not bad popular music to have.
Yes.
So that was why he wrote Don Giovanni for Prague, because they were absolutely nuts about Marriage of Figaro, which is his first collaboration with Lorenzo de Ponte, and they said, okay, get together again and let's have another one.
And Freeman's book is kind of about the myths and the legends, is it, rather than a kind of in-depth biography or historical research, anything like that?
Yes, I mean, he's very inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to rather dubious sources, like there's this chap Alfred Meissner, who was writing way, 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 almost a century later, 1870s, nominally basing what he wrote on notes left by his grandfather, who had lived in Prague, but he never showed anybody those notes or left them to any library. And I mean, we have absolutely no evidence that they existed. He may just have been making it up from hearsay, and a lot of what he says is clearly not possibly right, because he gives long verbatim dialogues. And Daniel Freeman, while acknowledging that this is rather dubious material, does put a lot of that in. And okay, it's fun to read. A lot of the real history is in there too. He doesn't really try to set himself up as a critic of opera in any way, but the circumstances of the productions are there, and a lot of the legend around them is also there.
And so then the other book that you wrote about was Jan Swofford's biography, which is a major work, isn't it, as all his biographies have been. What's the kind of central organising theme?
Yeah, I mean, one should say that Jan Swofford is a US composer and teacher, but he's surely going to go down in history as the person who wrote major biographies, first of Brahms, then Beethoven, and now Mozart. So, yes, it's a very solid biography. It doesn't necessarily include a lot of new information, but it gathers together everything that is known about Mozart currently. And it has a very persuasive line about him. I mean, Jan Swofford says, I think just straight up, Mozart was a happy man. It's a picture of a happy life. There's not much suffering here. There's not much penury. It's a man who's successful, who knows he's successful, who loves people, loves being with people, loves his wife, loves his friends, and has a happy life, as Jan Swofford says.
You say that he gives a sense of not just of him being a happy man, so there's no sort of tortured genius going on here, but he's got a sense of him treating life almost as playing a game, with a sense of detachment, and that if the game was a masquerade, he's Harlequin within that. Does that feel right to you?
It does feel very right. It does, and it's, as Jan Swofford points out, we're pre-romantic era here. Composers don't see it as their job to express their personal pains and anguishes. I mean, Mozart expresses all kinds of things, from pain to awe and delight and sheer joy and abounding love. But he doesn't do so as a subjective being. I mean, those are characteristics of the music. And it was perfectly possible for him to write a joyous piece at a time when he might have had some doubts about and problems with things, and conversely to write an anguished piece when he was blissfully happy. Those were things that were coming out of the music.
There's also that sense, isn't there, that he can, I'm always surprised by the music, especially in Così. I'm thinking about Così fan tutte, when there's a lot of deception going on, but he can give the most beautiful pieces to people who are conning other people left, right and center. Like when the sisters and Don Alfonso are saying goodbye to the soldiers, and Don Alfonso knows that the whole thing is a sham, and the sisters are perhaps overreacting anyway, and they sing Suave Ciel Vento, which is this beautiful, beautiful piece, but actually nobody really means it on that level, do they?
No. Well, there are various levels on which they do mean it and don't mean it. I mean, that's true to life, isn't it? I mean, so many relationships are not very clear. I mean, they can be one thing one day and one thing another, or they can be two or three different things at the same time. But I mean, going back to what we were saying about the masquerade, yes, Mozart is somebody who was perfectly capable of putting a mask on, who enjoyed masquerade, who enjoyed actually taking on the personality of Harlequin. And it's not too much of a stretch to see him as doing that in life. And in Così, as you said, yes, the boys are hoodwinking the girls, but the girls are play acting in some ways and enjoying the feelings of desire or of depression or of anger. There are many ways in which people are deluding themselves as well as deluding others in that piece.
But they do it to the most extraordinary music.
Exquisite music, yes. Maybe the most beautiful music in any Mozart opera.
And he wasn't, you say this and Swofford says this, he wasn't a revolutionary composer in the sense of inventing new forms or feeling that he had to push boundaries, was he? Sort of didn't need to break the conventions. Swofford says he took what the world offered him, digested it, and gave it back in his own voice.
Yeah, in his own voice, crucially. I mean, yes, he adhered to the conventions. His forms are normally in one of the standard forms of the period, but the way he handles it and the way he can move outside what you expect into a completely strange and wonderful territory is unique to him. There is nothing else like it in that period. I suppose in Haydn to some extent, but Haydn's a totally different composer.
The book sounds very interesting on the Salieri-Mozart relationship. I mean, he's Swofford says that he describes Salieri as having an orchestral imagination at least the equal of Mozart's, maybe beyond, which I thought was very intriguing. Is that something you buy?
I can't really. I mean, I don't know enough Salieri to appreciate Salieri as an orchestral composer. Obviously, Jan Swofford does, but that's one of the rare things in this book that makes you say, what?
Should we know Salieri a bit better? Because I mean, I'm coming to this as a complete amateur. I know really nothing about Salieri apart from the kind of biographical element of the relationship. And you know, do people listen to him much now?
Largely thanks, I'm sure, to the Peter Schaffer play. Salieri's music has been revived a lot in the last 30, 40 years, and there are recordings of several of his operas. And there are video recordings on YouTube of several of his operas. So the material is out there in a way that it just wasn't before Peter Schaffer's play came along.
I don't know anyone who could hum you a Salieri tune, though. He hasn't quite.
But he was very popular. And Swofford points out that his operas were performed more often than Mozart's. That's not only true of Salieri, it's true of other composers of that period, Cimarosa, Paisiello, and Fossi, who's virtually forgotten name. They all were more performed than Mozart. And there is a reason for that. Their music is simpler. It's froth. And that went down very well.
It's interesting when you're mentioning the Peter Schaffer play and the film, because there's lots of the Mozart stories that we might know. You quote the was it Joseph II saying too many notes? Lots of them can't be substantiated, but a couple of them, like the apparently, as Swofford says, the jealousy of Salieri, and also Mozart's sort of fairly astounding facility. They are more or less true, aren't they?
Well, Swofford is a little bit of two minds about
Salieri's jealous. Why should he be jealous when he was so much more successful? And Swofford gives us a long list of ways in which he was more successful, and then ends up saying, but human life makes no sense. And I like that. And I think Mozart was very much of approved of that sentiment, that that life doesn't make any sense. Maybe that's the big lesson of Così fan tutte.
Yeah, maybe. But also, in the Schaffer play, Salieri is jealous because he knows how good Mozart is, doesn't he? And he knows he can't do it.
I mean, that's a very nice thing in the play, that Salieri is really uniquely equipped, uniquely able to realise just how great this music is. I mean, there's that wonderful scene where he hears this wind serenade and is just struck dumb by this oboe melody, as any of us might be. But for other people in the play, this is entertainment, and they don't take it any more seriously. He's the one who sees Mozart's importance, Mozart's gift. But I don't think there's any evidence for that. I mean, it does make wonderful drama, and it makes a wonderful dramatic character.
But, and also his amazing facility. But I suppose then that came, he had to work very hard, didn't he, from when he was a child. So that might account for that as well.
Yeah, well, Leopold Mozart comes in for quite some stick in Jan Swofford's book, probably not altogether unreasonably. But Leopold did take this, he also, of course, recognized Mozart's gift, and he made it his business to take this lad around Europe so that he heard music making in London, in Milan, in Florence, in Paris, all over the place in Western Europe, and met great composers of the time, J.C. Bach in London, his major Italian contemporaries in Italy, and was exposed to the music and was copying the music. So he had a musical culture which was absolutely unique, and he could draw on what he'd heard of orchestras all over Europe, all over Western Europe anyway.
So yeah, some of it true, some of it not, but all the beauty all very much obviously there. Paul, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, the decline and fall of Labourism in Britain, new evidence that two of England's greatest philosophers were in dialogue with each other, deciphering obituary codes, and the Buddha's wife. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Watching the end of One Night in Miami, I was reminded of the end of a play called Abe Lincoln in Illinois by Robert E. Sherwood, which ends with Lincoln having won the 1860 presidential election and heading off to Washington. And people are in tears at the end of that story because they know what's coming. You know, what's coming is civil war and Lincoln's assassination.
I think those labels, they all really annoy me. Actually, I find them fantastically unhelpful because they're either used to punch up or punch down. And really, it just means that a lot of people enjoyed reading the book. Well, then Hilary Mantel is middle brow, and so is Shakespeare, and so is Ulysses. A lot of people have enjoyed Ulysses. Actually, that you probably can't make that case. I'm making a risk at that point.
I can remember when I was a student, not that we called ourselves students, this is such a long time ago, looking up and noticing that virtually every road to publication, because I was already writing poems myself at that stage, had Anthony Thwaites standing on it somewhere or other. In other words, he was absolutely the person who'd sort of managed to install himself as the person who was somehow kind of overseeing what was going on in English poetry.
One of the things that struck me is that with all the attention focused, quite rightly in fact, on the recent troubles in the north, it is quite easy to overlook earlier conflicts which ravaged the whole of Ireland, causing what Sean O'Casey amusingly called a terrible state of chassis. Though in truth, there is nothing amusing about any of them.
The Nancy Mitford that we had been talking about a couple of weeks ago, Heywood Hill, I think must be the grandest independent bookshop, don't you think? I'm pretty sure it's got a warrant from the Queen. Nancy Mitford worked there while she was writing The Pursuit of Love.
Did she?
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Because there's the bit in The Pursuit of Love where she's running a bookshop and they all come in and chat. And I think basically that's also
right. So it's method. Method it
is. I think it was a bit.
And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer, exclusive that is to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5 or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So you'll have the paper turning up on your doorstep every week, where you'll find all the pieces we've talked about on this podcast alongside dozens of other pieces, as well as getting access to everything online and in the app edition. Should you find yourselves waiting for a bus without your print issue handy. The digital access also includes the website and app archives and the historical archive, which goes back to 1902. So you can look up Walter de la Mare and T.S. Eliot and read what Virginia Woolf made of D.H. Lawrence, Joseph Conrad and Aldous Huxley. There's original writing by Roland Barthes, Saul Bellow, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Chinua Achebe, Patricia Highsmith, Umberto Eco, and Susan Sontag, and poems by Hardy, Auden Frost, Plath, Larkin, Brodsky, Paul Muldoon, and Anne Carson. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we turn to coal mines, let's have a look at what's in the rest of the paper this week. Toby, there's a revelation, isn't there? As I say, a revelation of a few hundred years old, but a discovery nevertheless about two of our great philosophers.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very recent discovery of something quite old, and it's an extraordinary story. This so. Felix Waldman, the philosopher and historian, has found a written memoir by James Tyrrell, who was apparently the best friend of John Locke. He found this written memoir in the papers of a former historian of the Royal Society called Thomas Birch. And it's basically a trashing of Locke. So James Tyrrell, supposedly a friend, you know, with friends like these, writes of Locke: he was avaricious, vain, envious, and reserved to excess. He lost his temper with great ease. Being full of the good opinion that he had of himself, Locke esteemed only his own work and the people who praised him. And it goes on. So it's really, you know, it's really quite rancorous.
I think it was also, wasn't it, weren't they looking for testimonials after he died and they couldn't use it? That's right, yeah. Isn't it? And he also says he wasn't interested in science or erudition, which seems surprising.
Absolutely, yeah. He despised science and
erudition. Oh, yes, that's right, yeah. Actively disliked them.
And then actually the two worst bits for Locke was that it accused him of plagiarism. So the book that he wrote about money, and that book is Locke's publications on the interest rate and the recoinage in the late 17th century, is a copy of another, says James Tyrrell. We don't know what the other is. And then the other really exciting thing for students and scholars of Locke is that there is proof that he was a reader of Leviathan. Now, this is really significant because it's always been suspected that Locke read Hobbes and read Leviathan, but he's never directly referred to it in his writings. And this seems to confirm that he was not just a reader of Leviathan, but a Leviathan obsessive
Yes, that's what it said, isn't it? That he was never far from a copy.
Yeah, he almost always had Leviathan on his table and recommended the reading to his friends. I think I'm not a Locke scholar, but I can see that this is hugely significant. And Waldman does a good analysis of the significance of this and what it means. And people have, talked about Locke in relation to Hobbes for hundreds of years, and whether or not he read Leviathan and, what his understanding of it might be. And this really will move scholarship on in a big way. In fact, I was party to the pitch when this piece came in, and Waldman says, a crass way to convey the importance of this discovery is to compare it to finding a completely unknown memoir of Shakespeare's closest friend recounting Shakespeare's plagiarism and other objectionable conduct. And I'm not sure if it's quite in the same category, but it certainly seems pretty close.
Yeah, and he does say that it will influence thinking about Locke now and about his work, and it will have a sort of huge impact, won't it, afterwards?
Exactly. So I think it's really, really exciting. There's going to be, this is not the... This is the first you will have heard of it, but it's not the last you will hear of it.
Mm, yeah, really, really significant find. There's another piece in the paper that I wanted to talk about obituaries.
Yes.
Which is a fun piece by DJ Taylor, talking about how you write them, how you read them, and what the codes are. And there's some lovely...
This is very funny about the codes.
Yeah, there's some lovely ones. I've got them here. There's this one I think I do know, No Stranger to the Grape, which means basically just means a drunk. So this is what when you read someone's obituary, because you're obviously, nil nisi bonum, you don't want to be horrible about people. But there are certain codes which mean certain things. He says, when recounting some flaring instance of alcoholic bad behaviour, you might say, X had perhaps taken a glass of wine. One of my favourites, I think, is enjoyed a variegated social life, which means light-minded boulevardier, which sounds like a brilliant thing to be.
Yeah, no respecter of reputations. He was really horrible.
Well, or actually, that's it says also literary critic, so watch out. Oh, that means, yeah. Or it just means rude.
Flamboyant, which means irksome scene stealer.
Yep. And larger than life, tedious show-off.
And then he also looks back, to the days when, people didn't necessarily want to talk about people being homosexual or gay in life when there were sort of more taboos on that. Although weirdly, we're actually talking about the '90s when it wasn't that taboo, but I suppose it still was in some areas. And you've got the kind of the classic he was unmarried, but then we've got Rupert Hart Davis trying to give an idea of his friend Hugh Walpole's sexual adventures, who settled for Turkish baths offered opportunities for informal social contacts.
There you go. What a way of what a way of putting it. Moving seamlessly on, the other thing that caught my eye, of course, lots of great things in the paper this week, but this one jumped out at me, it was a piece about the Buddha's wife. Did you see that piece?
Yes, I did. It was extraordinarily fascinating to me. I know almost nothing about Buddhism and the Buddha and Siddhartha, apart from, Hermann Hesse. It's a review of this. It's called a hagiographic fiction. So it's basically a novel.
Yes.
Sort of a
kind
of novel.
It's important to say
theology.
That at the start. Yeah.
Yeah.
but having said that, written by a professor of religious studies who specializes in Buddhism and who has anchored many of the events within historical research kind of thing. So it's a really interesting mix, isn't it?
Precisely. And it's about the Buddha, but sort of partly, or at least partly from the point of view of his wife, Yasodhara. And I mean, I maybe many listeners do know this, but I'm simply not aware of this. So the person who became Buddha, Siddhartha, abandoned his wife and...
Or renounced, because you have to renounce the things of the world, yeah.
Yes, exactly. But on the birth of his child. So he renounced them, I think, just as the baby was born. And it says here, Yasodhara emerges from the painful haze of childbirth to learn that her husband has left her, rendering the togetherness that defined her life. So it's also about her own renunciation, her own having to deal with this kind of abandonment. And it was just, I just wasn't really aware of that side of the Buddha's story. And it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, really interesting, I thought. And it's not sort of trying to... Right, it's not trying to say I wasn't that awful. It's not making judgments about it. It's saying there's a thing that happened. Let's look at it from another angle. It doesn't seem to be moralistic. It seems to be very thoughtful in it. And she not only has to deal with being renounced, but then she does her own renunciation, doesn't she? Because their son, after a while, leaves her to go off and follow his father. So she sort of has to renounce him. She has to let him go. If she loves him and wants to let him do what he wants, she has to let him go because she won't see him again.
So it's sort of as if renunciation was visited upon her, but then at the same time, she can either fight it or embrace renunciation. So it's sort of, and she seems to have done the latter.
And now in another seamless segue, Toby, you want to talk to us about coal mining, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. The Buddha was very into coal mining until he had to renounce it. so that's why we are making that link. The Industrial Revolution was powered by coal, and for many decades, Britain was the global leader in the field. It dug it up, burnt it, and sent it round the globe for others to do the same. Before 1939, the British mining industry was not national but hemispheric, writes the historian David Edgerton in his piece on the subject in this week's paper. The country was not only the biggest per capita producer of the stuff, but the largest absolute exporter of energy in the world. British coal mining went hand in hand with British labourism, and the slow decline of one meant the slow decline of the other. But only in the past three decades has the industry really collapsed, a disintegration mirrored by a similar collapse of the Labour Party's so-called Red Wall in the north of England, which has so fundamentally realigned British politics. But is the link between the two as simple as it seems? And what can we learn about the broader social and political effects of the demise of this once thriving industry? David Edgerton has reviewed The Shadow of the Mine, Coal and the End of Industrial Britain by Hugh Bainan and Ray Hudson, and he joins me on the line now to discuss. Hello, David.
Hello.
It's a really fascinating piece, and it sounds like a fascinating book. You describe it as a study of the lost world of British labourism. And I just wondered if we could start off by talking about what exactly you mean by labourism itself in this context.
Well, labourism is a term used by some left intellectuals to discuss the particularities of the British socialist Labour Party tradition. And I suppose the essence of it is the combination of a semi-socialist party with a strong organised labour movement. After all, the Labour Party was created by trade unions, and it was created to put trade union officials into the House of Commons. And that's profoundly marked its history, its politics, indeed down to the present day. There was, I think, a distinctive labourism at play within Labour.
And the coal mining industry was really a kind of sort of big central node of these unions. Would you say that's fair to say?
Yes, it was. I mean, the coal mining industry was quite strongly unionised and found it very important to have trade unionists in the House of Commons. I mean, first as Lib Lab MPs associated with the Liberal Party, and then from 1910 onwards, as Labour MPs. And the reason for this was that they were, as a union, as unions in the plural back then, very interested in having state regulation of the mines, to keep women out, to keep children out, to regulate the hours of work, to regulate methods of payment. So it's the involvement of the industry with the state that's central to the politics of the miners.
And so the book itself, The Shadow of the Mine, the book itself, what exactly is its scope? I mean, does it kind of start off with this kind of earlier history of the Labour Party, or is it more centrally focused on the kind of the past 30 or 40 years?
Well, it's really focused on the last 30 or 40 years, but looks back really to the post-war years. That goes a bit further back as well. And it focuses on two particular coal mining areas. And it's one of those really good books about the mining industry and mining trade unions that recognises that local traditions are very different in different areas. And the book focuses on the South Wales area, the area of the Fed. The Federation was the union for that area. And the Durham coalfield, where the Durham Miners Association was the union. The latter sort of long been associated with the right of the trade union movement and the Labour Party, and the South Walian miners with the left, and Aaron Bevan would be an exemplary figure there.
Picking up on that, David, we can still see those traditions pretty strongly today, can't we? I mean, that's how the Red Wall and the collapse of the so-called Red Wall happened, and that support is still relatively strong in Wales for the Labour Party.
Well, yes, it has remained relatively strong, although large parts of South Wales in particular, I mean, voted for Leave. I don't myself like the term the Red Wall. It's an invention by a conservative thinker. It's not something the Labour Party has developed as an idea, but it's one it's most certainly taken up. And it's a very curious idea because if we go back to the 1950s, the Labour right essentially argued that Labour needed to move away from the trade union movement, from the working class, the organised working class, because society was becoming more bourgeois, essentially. So they're essentially arguing that Labour had to move to the right and away from the working class. In the recent past, the Labour right has argued a very different thesis, which was that Labour should move towards the working class, and the working class was deeply, deeply conservative, and it was the bourgeois factions, if you like, that were the progressive ones, and indeed the problem for Labour.
There was certainly a sense of New Labour and Blair's New Labour kind of neglecting that area, though, would you say, and particularly in the north rather than so much in South Wales. I mean, you talk a little bit about the Durham Miners Gala, which is this important annual event, which I think Kinnock, you say, didn't go to, sort of stop, you know, he didn't go to it, Blair didn't go to it, Brown didn't go to it. And then for the first time in a long time, you've got Miliband and Corbyn went to it. And do you think this was very symbolically important?
I think it is. And the reason that Neil Kinnock didn't go was that he really wasn't very supportive of the miners' strike, the great miners' strike of 1984-85. And essentially, he would not have been welcome. It's interesting that later leaders who were also invited chose not to go. And I think certainly New Labour wanted to disassociate itself from the trade union movement. It wanted to see itself as a progressive party. It was New Labour, not Labour. It saw itself in a great progressive tradition, and aimed indeed to get its funds from membership and from private donors rather than from the trade unions. So there's a very clear sense in which Labour is distinguishing itself from the trade union movement. I mean, in relation to the mining areas, yes. I mean, the New Labour idea was that we had entered into a new world, a globalised world, a world in which new technologies were central. Mining certainly didn't come into the story of the conception of Labour, the New Labour had of what a modern economy looked like. So yes, these areas were, well, neglected isn't quite right. I mean, there were attempts through development agencies, through particular kinds of investment to revitalize and modernize these areas. But as the book shows rather wonderfully, essentially the best that these areas got was foreign manufacturers looking for cheap labor, and they were choosing between investing in Eastern Europe or in these mining areas. And there's a telling point, I think, which is often ignored, but Bain and Hudson bring out, and that is that the decline of the coal industry is not wholly due to the lack of demand for coal. What happened especially from around 1990 onwards was that British coal was being replaced by coal imports. And under New Labour, for the first time, coal imports were greater than British domestic production. So British power stations were running essentially on imported coal, on Russian coal, on Polish coal, on Colombian coal.
It's interesting that I think that the general narrative you might have thought was that the closing of the mines and the miners' strike in 1984-85 was the beginning of the end, but you know, was catastrophic for them. But it wasn't 1984-5 that did it necessarily.
No, absolutely. The key decisions are really the decisions of the 1990s, essentially, to import coal. I mean, they were implicit in the 80s policies, but they really come into play in the 90s. And it's a hugely important decision. We don't care where our coal comes from. I mean, that would have been a position unthinkable in the 1940s, 50s, or 60s, especially for the Labour Party. It would have, of course, have insisted that British coal be used where coal was needed.
Well, and you can see that, yeah, it makes even...
Coal to Newcastle,
even
Jig. Is an old expression,
isn't it? Exactly. It is literally coals to Newcastle, literally. In fact, coal exporting ports became coal importing ports.
And do you see corollaries in other declined industries in the UK today? I was thinking, for example, the sort of the shipyards in Scotland and you know, the sort of the impact of that on Labour politics, regardless of, you know, whether it was the Conservatives or Labour who presided over that decline.
Yes, that's right. It's the coal case is a particular one, given the nature of the coal industry. It's partly essentially a rural industry or semi-rural industry rather than an urban one. But deindustrialization has been a phenomenon right across the country. It's not just in the north, actually. It's also in London, various parts of the south of England as well. But the political consequences have been similar in some places. And perhaps the most striking example that's not usually discussed in this context is that of Scotland. Labour was a hugely important, in many ways, dominant part of the politics of Scotland. It ceases to be with the rise of the SNP. And it's very interesting that in the Scottish case, and there is a lot of deindustrialization in Scotland, you have the working class and the former working class voting for essentially the Social Democratic Party, and indeed, of course, voting to remain in the EU. So again, politics is really important to the story, it seems to me. The whole idea that left behind Britain voted Leave and Tory for some deep historical reason seems to me to be quite wrong. And in fact, and it's wrong to associate either the Leave or the Tory vote with these areas. The great bulk of the Tory vote, the great bulk of the Leave vote was amongst wealthier people in wealthy parts of the country.
Do you think that Labour can rebuild itself in these areas, you know, in these specifically the coal mining areas in the north? Do you see hope for that, or is that too difficult a question to even contemplate?
Oh yes, I mean, Labour has rebuilt itself in the past. It rebuilt itself in a particular way as New Labour. So there's every possibility of doing it again. But I think what Labour needs is a distinct view of the country and where it should go, as it had in 1997 and in 2017. I don't think the future lies in believing stories by the political enemies about the Red Wall.
The 2017 case is really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, you talk about how Corbyn's been routinely blamed for the collapse of Labour support in the north, and yet he did very well in 2017. He obviously did a lot less well in 2019. I mean, to what extent then was this sort of the split Tory Brexit vote the reason for his success, or actually do you think there was something more intrinsic to the appeal of Jeremy Corbyn in 2017 that actually got him those votes?
Yes, I mean the share of the vote is the key index, I think, and that's around 40% in 2017, which is an astonishingly good result. Why was Labour successful? I think it had a message. It attracted young people, fundamentally. And it did poorly amongst older people, for sure. And those older people are more likely to turn out to vote. But it certainly mobilised a large swathe of opinion, despite the deep hostility of the media towards it, and indeed the deep hostility of much of the Parliamentary Labour Party as well. So I think it was a very interesting and important phenomenon.
How does the book conclude then? What does Shadow of the Mind leave us with? Are there any kind of insights into the future, or what's its kind of parting shot?
Its parting shot, I suppose, is that it's simply that these mining areas have being betrayed. So it's a fairly bleak prospect that the authors give us. Where they are a bit more positive is in the development of political organization. And a nice example that they talk about is the recreated Durham Miners Gala. There is no mining industry anymore, but the gala has been rejuvenated as a political and cultural festival. I mean, one which I guess would look much more like our image of the supposed kind of metropolitan urban festivals rather than a northern so-called Red Wall one. But they certainly see it as a sign of possibility and of hope.
And is it mostly, do they sort of see that as kind of cross-generational, or is that mostly younger people do they feel is kind of driving that new sense of identity and togetherness?
I'm not sure, actually.
Oh, that's probably for the sequel then. I think that's probably all we've got time for. But yeah, perhaps Shadow of the Mind 2 will bring us up to date on that. It's been really great talking to you, David. Thanks so much for your time.
Is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Paul Griffiths and David Edgerton. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Toby Lichtig and from me, goodbye.